today, if we had a title for the sermon, and we'll just go ahead and just, Dave, will you bring up that lighthouse image? If I had a title for the sermon today, which I really don't, it would be Lighthouses, Dump Trucks, and So What? Makes sense, right? So, to get us started, to just get you present here with me and with us today, can you just say, so what? Say that.
So what?
All right, that was okay. But, how many of you have been a teenager at some point in your life? All right, how many of you are a teenager right now? And maybe one day you will be a teenager. I want you to channel all the teenage angst you can right now and say, so what? Come on. All right. That was pretty good. So, what? The lighthouse. That's where we're going to start first. My phone's not working, Dave, so we're going to have to work together. Lighthouse. One day I was coming home recently, and, you know, I was not having a good day. Some things have been going on in my world. I'll just tell you what it was. We were getting ready to close on this house, Angela and I, on our very first house, and then right at the end it fell through. I was like, oh. And then you go, well, okay, Ross, in the scheme of things, there are people right now just trying to find a place of refuge in Iraq. So it goes back to last week. What if me matters, but it's not the only thing that matters? So my situation mattered, and I was working through that, and I was like, I don't feel very good. So I called my sister, Joanna. And let me tell you about my sister, Joanna. She's my next oldest. She's 3.5 years older than me. And my dad's sitting in the room. Dad, would you confirm that Joanna comes from the School of Hard Knocks? Yeah. Dad just said, oh, yeah. Yeah. She learns, as we say, the hard way. How many of you are those people right now? Come on, be a little honest. Come on, it's cool. That's all right. We need those people. Because those people are pretty good at compassion most of the time. They get what it means to go through a valley. My sister gets that. So I called her, you know, and again, this is what's great about my sister. It's not that she's not going through her own woundedness. It's not that she hasn't compounded some of that woundedness with her own sin, and it's not that she doesn't feel stuck, but yet my sister took that good time to listen to me, little brother who's upset about how he lost this house. And as she's on the phone with me, I realize that all of her attention was for me. And just being on the phone with her was healing. And I was like, man, I've missed this person in my life. And I don't know if you know somebody like that, that no matter what's going on with them, they give you everything they've got to walk with you and to model that indeed God is with us and for us and moving us to something bigger even when we feel stuck. And so with that being said, I realized that what my sister is that. My sister is a lighthouse. You can't see it because it's kind of dark in here, but there's a little boat down there in the right corner, and over here, yeah, it's still the right corner, isn't it? It's okay. Yeah, okay. So, here I was in my boat down there, you know, just had drifted out, you know. I was just like, oh, gosh. You know, and I was stuck out there, and here my sister is this lighthouse. School of Hard Knocks, she's been through the valley. She knows what it means to her, and she just sends out a light signal very peacefully. Ross, if you just would come over here to shore, there's footing for you here. There's solid ground. Come over here. And I want to get you to say it again. Say so what with all that teenage angst. Go ahead. If theology, all of it, is not a lighthouse, we should just quit talking about it. If how we talk about God doesn't end up in our embodying that, being a lighthouse for and with and beyond each other, we need to at least start having a different conversation. Because that's what this is about. Jesus says it this way in Matthew 5. He says, you are the salt and light of the earth. That's who you are. You are the people who preserve everything in its worst moment. You are the people who give people light when they've drifted out and they feel like they will never come back to shore. That's what you are. You are a lighthouse. And in fact, all the ways we talk about God are getting at that. So, we're going to move forward with lighthouses, dump trucks, and so on. But before, will you pray with me? God, we thank you that you have been a lighthouse for us. You have brought us safely to shore sometimes when we had no clue that there was even a shore. And so now I just pray that you would gather us here and be our lighthouse now and enable us to be people of light that answer this so what powerfully and practically every day. In the name of Christ, amen. Dave, will you bring up Jonah 4:11? Sorry, it's cut off again. Jonah ends with this right here. God says, this is the end. Says God says, yet for my part, this is to Jonah, can't I pity Nineveh, that great city in which there are more than 120,000 people who can't tell their right hand from their left like me, and also many animals? That's the end of Jonah. Again, this is not the kids' version. Kids' version, again, summarized this way. Jonah's a righteous dude. God wants to be buddies with Jonah. Jonah said, I'm not sure about it. Gets swallowed by a whale and spewed out. God meets him again and says, hey, and they become buddies. This is not the kids' version. This is the adult version, the real on-the-ground wrestling version of Jonah. The context of this, again, if you don't remember, Jonah gets this vision from God that he is supposed to go start a conversation with his enemies. I just got a text from my sister. It just went off. Ding. He says, go start a conversation with your enemies. And Jonah says, which ones? Actually, he doesn't say this, but I like to picture it this way. Which ones, God? The Ninevites. You know, the ones who have murdered some of your people. You know those people who are ruthless. You know those people who are going to keep on keeping on with murder. Go talk to them. Go engage them in conversation. And Jonah runs away. God catches Jonah because that's what happens in our lives. And Jonah ends up doing this conversation. He sends out a message, a light, to the Ninevites, and they say, oh, our bad. And they respond. And Jonah is angry about it. And this is where we pick this up. Jonah's off on the shore, on the eastern side of the city, and he's mad with God because he says, God, you stepped over the bound. Your love's too extravagant. You shouldn't be loving these people. And God does this parable. And it ends with this question, can't I pity them? One commentary says this. It says that in this moment, this is sort of a gotcha moment. Like God's like, gotcha. Jonah has been mad that God's pitied the Ninevites. God makes this shrub appear, and it gives Jonah shade. When it disappears, Jonah's upset about it. He pities that situation, and God says, aha, gotcha. You pitied that shrub that you didn't make. I've got stake in these Ninevites. I made them. They matter to me. Can I pity them? Gotcha. I don't like that. Here's why. It minimizes what Jonah's been through. For the whole book of Jonah, Jonah's been honestly wrestling. He has been a righteous and faithful dude. He's been trying to get at this so what. And for this book to end with like a, ba-dum-tsh, gotcha. Thought I'd turn this off. So, in the end, I don't think that's what's going on. Another commentary says this. In the end, is Jonah a hero or is he an anti-hero? In other words, does he teach us something godly in the end? Or does he, well, yeah, still teach us something godly, but by messing up in big ways? I don't like that either because I think the answer is neither. I don't think Jonah is either a prophet or he's not. Or he's a hero or he's not. I just think Jonah is the prophet who is like us. I think Jonah is, yes, he has the gift maybe of seeing below the surface of human sinfulness, as prophets do. He has the gift of seeing beyond the present order of things, as prophets, yes, do. But he's been through a lot, and he's trying to reconcile what he still believes about God with what he's been through. How many of you have been there? You believe something about God, but when you are in your present circumstances or your past ones, you go, God, I'm still trying to believe this about you, but I don't know. And I'm a little frustrated about it. He's trying to get at this question. You know it. Say it one more time. More teenage angst again, please. So what, God? You're with us in our woundedness. You're for us when we compound that woundedness with sin. And you are moving us beyond even when we are stuck. But so what when it comes to these people who have hurt me? What happens when the rubber meets the road? So what? I think this question is so powerful, and here's my read of it. Because it is a lighthouse. Jonah is so mired in his mess, and I don't blame him for it. It's not the first time he's been mired in this mess. He's so out into sea that he cannot get the obvious. Sometimes we are so mired in our mess that even the obvious escapes us. What is close at hand just goes right over our head. And God gets through that by doing this. It's a really strange thing. God does this. He asks Jonah for permission. Can't I do this? Imagine God sitting next to you. And God asks you permission to have pity on your enemies. The obvious answer to that question is this. I bet you know it. Of course God can have pity on these Ninevites. Because why? Because God is God. But because God is with us, because God is for us, God sits down with Jonah and pierces through his calloused heart, almost like maybe a parent sitting with a child whom the parent loves and says, will you be on board with this? But because Jonah is so mired in his mess, the obvious escapes him. That the Ninevites, yeah, God should run after them. God doesn't say, can I forget them? Can I forget everything they've ever done and just wipe the slate clean? No, God says, can I give mercy to them? Can I go engage them? Sometimes we do that, don't we? We do this Jonah thing. I said last week we're with Jonah. Sometimes we're so mired in our own mess that we miss the obvious. We miss what's close at hand. When we ask this so what question, we miss what might be right before us because we are so stuck and we don't see the light. And I want to point out two ways that I think we do that. See if you agree. If you don't, write me an email this week. Number one, here's how we miss the mark. Activism! We go crazy with causes. We write our state reps. We fight for social justice day and night. We run ourselves ragged. We donate to 25 charities. And here's what's maybe happening. Underneath, there's a lot of personal wounds. There's a lot of hurt deep inside. And the reason that we do this cause thing is because we have this deeply held conviction that I can't be fixed, so I'm going to go try to fix everybody else. The other problem with that is sometimes we convince ourselves that we can actually fix the world. That's one mistaken answer to so what. Activism. The other one is this. Escapism. I know none of us ever do that, right? We throw up our hands and say, there's really nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do, ultimately. And this is also true to some extent. We should be active in the first case. This second one is also true. There are some things that are outside of our control that we cannot impact. And when we try to impact them, we actually kind of make them worse sometimes. But the problem with this when we escape is that we miss out that we have a real role and purpose to play in God's redemption story. And when we escape, we jettison that. I think there are two ways we escape. So now I've got like a big list and then a bullet and then a bullet. So sorry. There are two ways we escape. How about this one? Charity. Some of you are like, huh? Charity? I'm not saying all the things we do for charity are bad. And what I mean is this. Here's 50 bucks to this organization or here's 5,000. But sometimes I think that we give money to give ourselves permission to step back. We do charity to give ourselves permission not to really engage people, be with people in the mess. I've done it. Here's a second way we escape. Self-absorption. That never happens in our culture, right? Self-absorption. It's all about me, me, me. Sometimes when we throw up our hands, we say, there's really nothing I can do to fix this or be with that person, but good thing I'm saved in Jesus Christ because I've got my path paved to heaven, baby. But there's nothing else I can do, so I'm just going to wait. We escape. I think those two responses are spectrums how we respond to this so what question. Let's do it again. Say so what. Now the dump truck. The parable of the dump truck, this is in Matthew 5. I'm kidding, it's not in there. There's no dump trucks in Jesus' world. Justin Vance told me this story, and so this parable is inspired by true events. You ever seen that at the beginning of the movie? Which means that this parable I'm going to tell you is not true at all. It's a parable. There were two guys up on a roof taking off shingles. And then there's this dump truck that's kind of at a close distance to the roof, but it's really like maybe 5 yards away from the house. And these guys start working on the roof. You know, they're doing this hard labor of getting under the shingles and ripping them off. And they're throwing these thing a distance into this dump truck. It's over there. And the first guy is thinking to himself, gosh, I wish that thing were closer. Ugh. Throws it. And he keeps doing that, and he's watching this other guy hard at work. First guy goes, gosh, I wish that were closer, but boy, that other guy's working pretty hard. Maybe if I just do enough, we'll get this thing done. I'll just do enough to get by. That other guy will work pretty hard, and I'll just hurl another one in there, mosey on back, and peel off. The second guy on the roof is going nuts. He's like, picking up things, running over and throwing them, sweating like crazy, going nuts with this roof. But inside, here's what's happening in his head. I'm so mad at myself. I hate myself. I'm so sad. And he's just working so hard, trying to just, for a second, not think about how he hates himself. And he goes, gosh, that dump truck's far away. It's like my life. And just throws it. And this second guy keeps doing that until, you know, he's playing that game in his head until he does this. I'm just tired of it! And he's like, ooh. And says it out loud. First guy goes, you okay? What's going on? And the second guy goes, I'm sorry, man, I didn't. But the first guy goes, no, what's going on, man? He says, you know, I've been going through a lot, and sometimes I just get so angry with myself and so angry about my situation that I just scream it out. And to be honest with you, I'm tired of working on this roof, and I'm tired of that dump truck being really far away. And the first guy goes, you know what? I didn't want it to be that far away either, but I was kind of just watching how hard you were working. And I was really kind of concerned with myself. And so they go down and they say, let's move this thing. Neither one of them know how to move this dump truck, so they get into the dump truck and they sit there for a while and they're like, hey, do you move this stick this way? Oh, nope, that's reverse. Nope, and then they put it in the first, and by golly, they finally get it just close enough to where now they go back up to the roof, they work a little slower pace, walk over to the dump truck and drop them in instead of throw it. Some of you are like, Ross, what on earth did you just tell me about? This is what parables are like. As one of my teachers said, when it's confusing you, it's working. Our two responses to this so what are sometimes, number one, we get really active. We spread ourselves in 1,000 directions, and sometimes we're trying to compensate for our own woundedness. And we go and go and go and go and go until it just comes out. Or we're the other guy. We're trying to get through as well, and we're just totally self-absorbed. We're just totally consumed with our own thing. And we say, you know, maybe we'll just get to the end of the run. I'll be okay. I don't really care about that guy so much. There's not so much I can do. But we'll get there. The parable of the dump truck. Does that relate? Do you relate to that? I think there is a way that we can answer this so what question powerfully and practically based on all these words. Can you get those words up, Dave? Go to the communion slide and we'll just get all those words up. These are all the words from our series. There are powerful and practical ways that we can embody those top words to get at that so what word, which is the fact that we have a real role to play in the redemption story. I'm going to propose a couple, and then I'm going to actually encourage you to respond in a minute as we have communion. But I think if we're going to embody the fact that God is with us and for us and beyond us, here's how I think a couple of ways that we can embody this practically right now. So what? Number one, I think Scotty's Brewhouse gets this. Some of you are like, what? Last week, Beyonce was ministering to us. Now Scotty's Brewhouse is. Scotty's Brewhouse has shirts that say, does anybody know it? Who said it? What? Think globally, drink locally. And some of you are like, what? That's the answer? No. I'm going to switch out drink and put in be. Think globally, be local. Think local, think global, be local. Here's what I mean by that. I think in our world with countless causes and high levels of self-absorption, the best thing we can do is start right here at home. There are things that we can do locally, right here and now, in our own space, to engage things that are relevant and important, and it can give us energy to move out globally. It's not to say that the global stuff doesn't matter. I mean to say that there's stuff happening right here. It's like Jonah. There's obvious stuff close at hand that we can do to embody this so what. An example and proposal number one is this. Practical stuff. I propose that one thing we can do in this space is to be radically vulnerable with each other. That's something we can do inside these walls that can carve out a space for everybody to exist here. To be completely real, to not walk around that like I've got it all together and I've got it all figured out. That's a way we can embody this so what. When we're out there in the narthex, if you're having a bad day, you don't gotta like put a smile ear to ear on. If you're wrestling with faith issues, say that. Something we've struggled with in the traditional institutional church for years is that we've kind of showed up and played church sometimes. Have you ever seen that? We all do that because we're afraid. But if we're vulnerable, we start to show that we believe God suffers with all who are suffering. God never quits desiring us, and God always sees the bigger picture. We begin to belong with each other in powerful ways. Vulnerability is so powerful, and we can start doing that right now inside the walls of St. Mark's. That's one answer to so what. Here's another one, and this is the bigger one. The local thing. What can we do in our Carmel community and Indy metro area to be with people out there? What can we do? So I challenge you with that question. How can we, I wrote it here, how can we commit to being real inside these walls, but also with people out? What do we need to do in our community here in Carmel? I don't have the answer to that today. That's a powerful so what answer. There may be something right here close at home, right on Main Street in the Arts District that St. Mark's could be doing to embody with, for, beyond, to be a lighthouse, to be salt and light. Will you own those two questions with me this week? How can we be more vulnerable inside these walls, and what can we imagine that could happen out there in Carmel that we could do to be with people? So in a minute, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that on these whiteboards. But before we do that, I just want to give you a second to pick one of these words. We're going to give you 30 seconds or a minute. Which one of these words do you need to remember? From this series, and this will come into play in a minute, I promise you that. I want you to take a minute and just say, this is the word I need to take away and maybe embody. This is what I need to turn into so what? Hum, open, both, with, for, beyond. Take a minute to just write down which one of these words is the one that you need to hear and remember. Go ahead and do that. You can keep thinking on that. It's going to come up in communion in a second. But I just want to start to get that in your head to think about, as we think about what it means to be vulnerable here and how we can be locally grounded. I just want to put that in your head. So I'm done with what I wanted to say, but I also hope that you will welcome our guest today, surprise guest, Reverend George Davis. George, come on up. Give him a round of applause if you would, as a sign of welcome. And if you could, you know, when we're done afterwards, give George some really hearty applause because he's mourning right now because his Tigers are 0-2. So here you go, George. And here's why we got George here today. George's favorite question, one that he's challenged me with before, is so what? George Davis was pastor. Well, actually, I'll let you talk about that, okay?
Oh, go ahead. This is
interesting. Yeah. George was pastor of St. Mark's from, give me the years again. 92 to 2002. George Davis was here at St. Mark's thinking about that so what question. Now, he hasn't quit thinking about it, I promise you that. But I wanted to bring him up here to give us some perspective and wisdom about this so what question, because hopefully this is practical. So, George, question number one for you that I hope you respond to is, the earliest followers of Jesus called their movement the road or the way. Would you tell everybody a little bit about the road you've traveled as a pastor?
Now, he sent these to me ahead of time, so I've had a chance to think, and that may or may not be good, but
I wanted to be fair to George.
Yeah, the question he put it was the road you've traveled as a pastor. And the first thing I wrote down was to put an ING on that, because I'm still traveling. There's not some, you don't graduate from faith, at least I haven't, and so that's still happening. Probably the biggest thing that had to happen for me in going into pastoring work was everybody's patting you on the back saying, boy, this is great, aren't you a good guy? And I just soaked up all of that. I've decided that it is impossible for me to get too much acclaim or win too many awards. And that's not a positive thing necessarily. So I gobbled all that up and thought that's just great. Then you have to bury somebody. And you can't have pretense doing a funeral. Then you find out that not everybody in the church likes what you're saying.
What?
Some people want to, I know. I was trying to keep it secret from you, but some people want to go here, some people want to go there with the life of the church, and so I have to decide, how am I going to keep everybody happy? I mean, that's my job in life, and that's my profession, isn't it? Well, that's impossible. So somewhere along the line, what I eventually had to do was accept the fact that God had called me into a very difficult circumstance in which I was caught between my need for acclaim and my desire to serve. Still don't have all that worked out. But what it did say to me was the core of the whole thing was caring about people and not trying to control the outcomes of that care. And that's been the lifelong journey, if you will, of coming. For me, loving God and trusting God are the same thing. So if I can trust God to the outcomes, even with the people that are closest to me, that leaves me a little more free to try to do the next right thing in my life. And I don't do that in a vacuum. Fortunately, I've got a good wife who's somebody that I can confer with. I've got friends that I can talk to. I know how to read and struggle to pray and occasionally think. There's lots goes into deciding, okay, what's the next right thing for me? And sometimes that's not clear. You just have to go at it and leave the outcomes to God. So that's kind of been the unfolding. The other thing, I'm a goal-driven people. And those of you who know me know that I tend to be a task-oriented, goal-driven person. And that certainly was true while I was pastor here. And we did a lot of stuff. I just lost the will to continue to push that. And so I retired from parish work. And the first thing I did was to go to manual labor. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want anybody calling me. And did that for a while. I also picked up a second part-time job with the Carmel Police Department. And then as the years have gone on, the department's grown, I've traded those hours out, and so I'm employed by the Carmel Police Department half-time as their senior chaplain and do some other support service stuff for them and some special projects. For me, that was a transition of getting back into a kind of formal ministry, if you will. John Wesley, who started the Methodist movement, was a Church of England priest, and at one point he was still a priest, but they wouldn't give him a church. They didn't like the way he was going about his business, so he said, well, the world is my parish. And there's emphasis on the two key words there. Parish is a neighborhood, and so a church had a neighborhood of ministry. So he said, okay, the world is going to be my parish, and the world is going to be my parish, so that ministry in the world. And I had people say to me when I retired, well, did you lose your faith? No, not at all. Just changing my occupation. The task of ministry is still in the world with real people who've got junk going on in their lives and need an encouraging word once in a while. So at this point and at my age, my ministry is to finish well. Whatever that means in my life, as a witness to others, but certainly to my family and my children, to finish well, whatever that's going to mean. So anyway, that's kind of what that's about.
Yeah. Yeah, so answering the so what is not having it all figured out. And answering the so what is about not traveling to a destination, but continuing to travel. So a second question is, you talked a bit about wilderness with me as we met about this, and you talked about it today. When we talk about the church, what is wilderness? That's the first part of the question. Then what's one thing we need to remember about God in the wilderness? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think wilderness in the church begins with you and me, because we bring our chaos into this place. That's why the front pillars out there say the peace of Christ be with you, because we come in here spiritually bruised and battered a lot of weeks. And that's as true for me today as it was whenever. So that's part of the chaos and wilderness of the church. The other part of it is the church deciding what's going to be its standard of operation, if you will. And if we ever deviate from caring about people, then we've gotten off the track. There are untold number of packaged stuff you can buy to tell you how to, quote unquote, be a successful church. You know, they talk about an army travels on its stomach. If you can't feed the soldiers, the rest of it's not going to happen. And a church travels on its care in all the ways in which you and I need to be cared for. Sometimes that's an arm around the shoulder, and sometimes that, what on earth do you think you're doing? There are a lot of ways to care. But that's the wilderness piece for me in the church. And so it's important to remember that God's in control of the outcomes, and so we're free to struggle to do the next right thing.
So the question today was, so what? And everyone kept repeating it with, like, the good teenager inside. So what? And maybe pair that with what's the way forward for St. Mark's in your mind? You've had history here, but you're also a guy who's thinking about traveling into the future. So when the rubber meets the road, what's the way forward maybe for you?
Well, I think that's framed by and large on helping you and I to be caring people tomorrow. That's what we take into the world. I notice, and I forget it all the time, but as you leave this room, there's a sign over the door that says, enter his gates with thanksgiving. But we're going out into the world. They didn't put that sign coming in. We put that sign going out. And the people who started this church and built this sanctuary did that to remind us that thanksgiving is expressed out there. Not as a sentimental feeling. It's great when we feel thanksgiving, but it's important that we live thanksgiving. And then as you go out the door, it says the courage of Christ be with you. We tend to get away from battle imagery in the church because we're all supposed to be nice people who are smiling at each other. But the fact is, I experience a lot of battle in life. Now, maybe that's saying more about me than it is about the reality of human experience. But we need courage in order to deal with a world that I think is constantly in the grip of a fatalism that's saying, hey, it's all up for grabs. Well, we're supposed to know better than that. So the way ahead for the church is to continue to ask, how do we support, educate, encourage people to be more caring? And that's not an easy thing. I mean, some people are in some pretty difficult circumstances in which they want to do anything but care. But that's the dialogue that goes on, and the comment about being vulnerable to one another is right on target. We need to be able to receive that support from one another, and if all we're doing is grabbing something to help me get through the next day instead of being a caring person in the world, then I'm probably going to short-circuit myself. That'd be a shame. So I think the way ahead is the church realizing that we're here to support each other and to be caring people in the world. Anything we can do to make that happen is a positive thing for us to do. Sooner or later, that's going to take resources of one sort or another, so it didn't get away from dealing with the practical issues of being an organization, but at least it has a target and a goal that has some positive outcome to it.
The tiger's going to come back?
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
Talk about trusting outcomes. So.
There you go. I'm a Red Sox fan, and my team beat his team last year, so I just want to remind you that.
I don't know.
Okay. Well, thank you, George, and
thank
we'll
you.
See more of you as we have lunch today. But please give George a round of applause for being here.